The following is intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
We're going to go all over the place on today's podcast because Travis Elborough has written a book called Atlas of the Unexpected. I love this book, and it's... You might not consider it a travel book. I do. But there are some places on this in this book that are just so outlandish, so weird, that I've actually, they're on my bucket list. Like, for example, the ruins of an abandoned utopian town in Brazil that was created by Henry Ford. Seriously. That's in this Atlas of Unexpected Places. Or a group of indigenous people who live on very small islands that they wove themselves. And you can also eat these islands, too, because the plant that they use to weave the islands is also their major food source. That's in this book. Also, a beach in California that the sand has been replaced by glass, but sea glass. And I would like to visit this place also. It's all in Travis Elborough's Atlas of the Unexpected. We'll be talking to him shortly on the Travel with Hawkeye podcast. But first, we're going to a place that's very expected, New York City. We actually featured New York City a couple podcasts ago to talk about Christmas. And I invited Michelle Rodriguez to be our guest on the podcast. You may recognize Michelle. She was on a podcast a few, probably about a year ago. We both actually went to Rome.
But recently, we both went to New York City on vacations, basically at the same time, me with my wife, you with your mom and your nephew.
Right, unplanned.
Yeah,
like,
unplanned.
You just mentioned it. I'm like, wait, this weekend? This weekend?
So when we got back, we compared our vacations in New York. And it's kind of funny. We had some similar experiences and some...
Completely different.
Yes,
completely
at the different. Exact same types of attractions. First of all, let's start off with the Rockettes at Radio City Music Hall. We both went to that. What was your impression of that?
That was amazing. I mean, I had seen the traveling show, and I'm sure some of them, you know, some maybe you've seen it as well. But
I know I never have.
It doesn't compare.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear the Rockettes traveling throughout the nation, and you're like, oh, cool, it's the New York City Rockettes, the Radio City Hall. And when I saw them a few years ago, it was great, but nothing like it is at Radio City Music Hall.
It was incredible. I didn't really know what to expect. My wife really wanted to go, and I was like, okay, you know, and I was blown away. It was like a 2-hour show.
Yeah, and you think it's just girls dancing on stage.
No.
It is so much more
than
that.
There was like a 3D movie in the middle of it.
Yeah. Santa came out. I mean, and it's
a story.
It's like a musical. Yeah, yeah. There's like a Broadway musical attached to that, which you don't expect. But I mean, you're right. The 3D stuff was just amazing.
And then the whole theater is part of the experience. I mean, like, there's stuff projected all over the big domed ceiling of Radio City Music Hall.
There's so much to look at. It's not just whatever's on stage. And I don't know where you sat. Did you sit in the orchestra as well?
Yeah.
Okay, so we sat in the orchestra. But I mean, I think anywhere you sit in that place would be amazing.
I think if you went up in the balcony, you would have an amazing time.
Yeah, because there's something going on. I mean, you're looking to your left, your right, and you're looking up.
Yeah. Yeah, they start the show off with this massive organ concert, like, you know, a couple of Christmas songs.
That was about 15 minutes before, wasn't it?
Yeah. And to get you kind of primed up for the show.
Yeah, so you want to get there early, but you said not too early.
We got there way too early. They tell you to get there an hour before the show. You don't need to get there that early.
No, but it was awesome. You walk in and they have concessions everywhere. They have the popcorn. If you were a Chase card member there at the time, you would get like a discount. But I learned that you would have to actually go to the concessions to get that discount.
Oh, okay.
Because we bought a little one of, because it looks like a circus. They sell that stuff.
They have a lot of concessions.
Yes,
They're selling a lot of stuff.
You can even
get your picture taken with a Rockette.
Yes, you can do that after the show. But I did buy one of those little light thingies.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, circus prizes.
We bought a Rockette Christmas ornament. So.
Oh, that's cute. Yeah, there's a lot to buy. So.
Okay, so we would say that was definitely a 5-star attraction.
Yeah, that was the best.
Yeah, okay. We also went to Macy's Santa Land. You went there also.
At your recommendation.
At my recommendation, which is a free thing to go to. And it takes about half an hour to go through, I think.
Yeah. Okay. But you know what? It wasn't a half an hour for me. There was nobody there.
Oh, so you went like 5 minutes?
It's like, wait, slow down. Slow down. There's something to see here. And I think it is nice to have the hustle and bustle. I think it's nice to have people there because you do slow down to see and enjoy
everything.
It.
Yeah.
You're not just getting to Santa.
Yeah. Oh, so you like rush through to get to Santa. Oh, see, there was a long line to get to Santa, so we slowly walked through
Santa
Land. Oh,
see, I didn't get to enjoy it that way.
Well, that's your own fault. Yeah. That's not Macy's fault.
Well, I had a four-year-old with me.
Okay, all right. So this is the funny thing here, is our experiences at Santa are quite different. We actually, when we went to Macy's Santa Land, we just kind of wanted to check out Santa Land. We weren't really even going to go see Santa. And we thought we'd just skip, and we thought, we'll just get a picture.
Right.
And this was my wife and I. We're adults. We had such an incredible time seeing Santa that as soon as we got there, he knew our names, which I'm sure.
Yeah,
you know,
one of the elves told us.
Yeah,
Santa.
I'm sure. Yeah. But, you know, he was so heartwarming. And we spent like 10 minutes with Santa. And my wife said I started to cry and called him grandpa.
No way.
It was so wonderful. But he was like, oh, Mark and Madeline, I haven't seen you for so many years. You've grown up so well. I'm so proud of you. It's so great to see you again after all these years. And he asked about our extended family.
So incredible.
It was really an incredible experience. It was really heartwarming. And I thought, man, I can't wait for Michelle to go through and see Santa because it was
so
wonderful.
Yeah, and I saw your pictures and they looked and you were talking about it on your social media. And I was looking forward to it.
Yes. And then when you went to see Santa, it was a little bit different.
It was nothing like that.
And this is the exact same Santa Land at Macy's, which, by the way, we pretty much figured out there's at least three different rooms with three different Santas. Probably to move the line along a little faster.
Yeah, I didn't get a charming Santa. I mean, I'm sure he's great, a great person, but not like we didn't have that kind of conversation.
Yeah.
It wasn't, and you know, I hate to say it, didn't look like Santa. Not like your Santa. I didn't get the same Santa you got.
It didn't look like, it looked like a guy in a Santa costume.
Yes. Well, and I was sad about that.
Did your nephew, four-year-old nephew.
Oh my goodness. He was so in love. His eyes were just, you know, and that's what it's all about. And that's really what it's all about. I mean, but after you had that experience, I wanted the same Santa experience. And it was more like 10 seconds in and out.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, maybe the deal is, like, since you had a four-year-old, obviously that was more for the four-year-old, and they figured give the four-year-old who doesn't have the discerning eye is not going to tell the difference.
Exactly. I think that was probably it. So crazy.
Well, I hope you get the good Santa if you go to Macy's.
Yes.
Okay, here's another thing that we did not get a chance. Well, we saw a bunch of the department stores and the windows and all that. We thought that was pretty cool. The night that we were going to go check out Saks at night,
yeah, Saks Fifth Avenue.
It was raining, and so we ended up not going. And I heard I missed out on a lot. There's music. It's all lit up.
Yeah, you know what? And it was something that I think I took for granted because I went last year, and I saw it passing by, and there's a lot of people that stop by. In fact, traffic slows down.
Yeah, I'm sure
because
it does.
Everyone just lines up the sidewalks, and you know they have an entire song orchestrated to lights.
Yeah,
and it's song after song after song. But I had seen it last year, and we're like, oh, okay, here, because we were going to Mass.
Uh-huh.
We were going to St. Patrick's.
Right next door.
Yes,
right next. Yeah.
So we stopped by, and we took a few videos and a few pictures, and we just couldn't get close to the windows, obviously.
It was so crowded.
It was so crowded.
Yeah.
You have to come at a different time if you want to enjoy the windows.
Yeah.
Not when it gets dark and you start to see the I mean, it's just amazing. The way they orchestrate that, the entire building lights up with Christmas lights.
Pretty amazing.
On and off. And I mean, it's just like, it's something to check out.
Well, the big department stores you have to see are Saks.
Yes.
Macy's.
Macy's had Believe in Santa or something like that display outside.
Bergdorf.
Yes, I saw.
Almost across the street. Bloomingdale's, which is a few blocks away. And Lord & Taylor, which, by the way, this year their windows just said going out of business. Everything 50% off.
That's sad.
Very sad. We went by Bloomingdale's. We drove by it in a cab, actually. Did you get to go to Bloomingdale's? Theirs is supposed to be pretty good.
No, I don't know.
It's kind of like, it's like on 61st Street.
It's a bit of a walk to get over there. Yeah. I was trying not to get on the road because it's impossible to get out.
So what else did you do? You went to Rockefeller Center?
Yeah. And we went to Mass. We went to St. Patrick's Cathedral there right next door to Sunday.
Yeah.
That's what we were going to do. We were going to do Sunday Mass.
Uh-huh.
And we got there about 30 minutes before. We still got a front seat because there's off to the side. There's seating, and I don't think a lot of people knew that you could go straight down and just sit to the sides, and you're still up front.
What is Mass like at Christmas season at St. Patrick's? Is it packed?
There's a lot of people. There's a lot. Yeah, I mean,
it's a huge cathedral.
Yeah, it's huge. Any other church would be impossible to serve that many people, but yeah. they have it handled well. They have
it's like
so
the
many.
Yankee Stadium of churches.
Yes. Yes, so amazing. There was a very long line. There's one bathroom in there, so ladies, plan ahead.
Okay. Anything else that you did? We went ice skating, by the way, Central Park. Highly recommend that.
I did see that. I didn't go to Central Park this time around, but that looked like it was awesome. Was it packed? Was there a lot of people?
Yes, it was very packed, and it was very crowded. Like, I guess that's what packed means. it was crowded. I mean, it was worth it. We really enjoyed the experience, but it was very crowded.
That's cool. Yeah. But then you also went to the toy store. See, that was another experience that was different.
We never got into the toy store.
Oh, you didn't?
FAO
okay.
Schwartz. Did you get in there?
No, I did, but I was right out. Like, I should just. You couldn't move.
Uh-huh.
You could not move. We were like, okay, we need to just because we had the 4-year-old with us. Yeah. It was just not. We told him we were going to go get food, which is another thing. It's very expensive.
Well, New York City normally, yeah.
Yeah.
But FAO Schwartz, they just reopened in Rockefeller Center. Yeah. And the line, when we went by, the line was like an hour, 2-hour wait to get inside the store to go shopping.
Oh, my gosh.
And we're like, we're not doing that.
It wasn't. And I guess they were about to close. I think that's why. There wasn't a lot of people, and they were, like, moving them through.
Well, Johnny Jett of JohnnyJett.com told me the best time to go is right in the morning, right before they open up. And they, you know, so there's a line, but once they open up, everybody in line goes in and get right in. So
that's
if
nice.
We ever go back.
Yeah, that's, yes.
Right at the open.
Something to do.
Well, overall, your experience, would you say it was worth it for others?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's just so much to do.
Yeah.
And I was there 4 days, and I didn't get to do everything.
Yeah.
Nothing. I mean, I didn't get to go to Central Park. I wanted to go to the Museum of Natural Art. And, I mean, that was just, you have to plan ahead because there is a lot of traffic. So, put at least... block out 2 hours to get anywhere 5 miles, not or, even 5 miles what, away, half
well,
a mile away.
Well, see, here's the deal. We're with a 4-year-old, so you can't walk as far.
No,
as like,
no.
That makes a big difference. We walked everywhere for the most part, took the subway.
That's awesome.
Did you take the subway?
I did not.
I saw that social media post where you were going to.
I did not.
Were you scared to take it?
It was closed, so it was like, okay, all right.
How late was that? How late were you at?
No, it was under construction, that entrance.
That entrance was closed.
Yes.
Okay, all right. Okay. Were you scared to take it, though?
I am scared. I'll have to read up on that. You'll have to do a whole podcast on the subway.
I will say, once you get down there, you'll see it's just a mix of all sorts of people, and you'll feel very safe because there's just tons of people down there.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's very safe. I lived there in the 80s. I never went on the
subway
in the 80s, but one time, and I was scared to death. But nowadays, it's very, very safe.
So it's completely different than it was in the 80s.
Oh, I would say, it's clean. It's the graffiti's all gone and everything. Yeah, it's very, very safe.
Well,
but overall,
awesome.
You say it was a good experience.
It was great.
Yeah.
How was it for you?
I would say the same thing. I definitely, if you're thinking about going, you want to spend some Christmas time there, it does not disappoint.
Yeah, it'll put you into the holiday spirit without a doubt.
Thank you, Michelle Rodriguez, for joining us on the podcast. From New York City, we travel to parts unknown around the world as we visit with Travis Elborough, author of the book Atlas of the Unexpected. We mentioned this in the intro. You go to all these unbelievably weird, strange places. First of all, how long did it take you to write this book?
It was about a year or so for this particular book. I mean, some of the places I visited, you know, in the past, and some I was seeking out, and some I unfortunately didn't get to visit, but they were all, they had some sort of, some fantastical element about them. You know, they were either unexpected in the sense that they were historically an accidental discovery, or there was some architectural oddity about them, or, you know, there was just something quirky and strange about them that sort of drew me to them.
Yeah, I'm going to let you choose, first of all, your two favorite places in the book, and then I'm going to choose some places that I'd like to know more about, okay?
Well, I mean, I suppose one of my favorite places in the book, because it's just quite bizarre, to be honest, is Chess City in Elistra, in sort of the Russian Republic of Kalmykia, which is a kind of complex where the former president of this republic was a chess fanatic. And so he created this entire city around the idea of chess. So there are chess-themed buildings, there are chess-themed halls. And it was doing quite well. I mean, it's fallen out of favor within the Russian Republic. Again, I think one of the things I like about some of these places are places that begin with a kind of a slightly utopian idea or something. There's some driving force for why they get created that maybe slightly has gone slightly awry. and therefore, you know, you're seeing that dream slightly faded, and maybe that, you know, you can see there's sort of a bit of hubris about them, perhaps, in a way, and that and that makes them oddly human in their sense of decay. I mean, there's also a slightly similar vein. There's a kind of Stalinist town just outside Poland, created in the 1950s, called Nowahuta, which also features in the book in a way, where, and it's kind of this sort of rigid, sort of brutalist structure of a city, kind of planned city. And it's both monumental and awe-inspiring and slightly terrifying in the way that something that's come out of some slightly totalitarian regime kind of would be, that you're both kind of awed, and it's both awe-inspiring and awful in kind of equal measure. And I was quite sort of slightly wrong-footed by quite how I felt about the place, but still nice to have a look at.
There's also some places in the book that, interestingly enough, started out as trash heaps and then ended up being interesting places. And there's two in particular. One is in California, called Glass Beach, which I would love to go visit this beach. Tell people about Glass Beach in California. It's in Fort Bragg, California.
Fort Bragg, as a town, was sort of supplied a lot of the lumber for the rebuilding of San Francisco. It's obviously a coastal town. And the town grew reasonably prosperous, largely supplying materials and things for the growing metropolis of San Francisco. Towns being as they were in a more profligate era, where the idea of the environment hadn't really... we haven't become kind of socially aware about the environment in quite the same way. So there was just an area of the beach which was known as the dumps, which, true to its name, was where any old rubbish would be thrown. Old cars, fridges, you name it, were kind of dumped there. It became sort of environmentally conscious in the sort of 60s and 70s, and so the rubbish dump was sort of closed down. But nature, in a way, had its way with a lot of the rubbish. A lot of the rubbish was kind of washed away by the sea and the tides and so on. And over time, some of the discarded rubbish, particularly sort of glass, was sort of broken down. It's created this very strange beach where there are these sort of wonderful little, pellets of coloured glass and stuff on the beach itself. And now, actually, the beach, you can't, there's a local law passed it, and there's now like a preservation thing. You can't take the little stones away from the beach. So the beach has, nature in a way, has turned, sort of reclaimed the beach and reclaimed some of this rubbish. Obviously, the metalwork and stuff, I think, was sort of pulled away, but enough of it was turned into this rather strangely idyllic beachfront where there's all this glittery, strange glass.
It's interesting too, because I love sea glass and I always collect it. But so when I heard there's a whole beach that's just sea glass, which is very smooth, the ocean smooths it down to make it very, the edges are rounded, so you're not going to cut yourself walking on it. It's really an interesting phenomenon.
No, exactly.
But to see a whole beach of that, how cool. I would like take tons of that. I'm glad they kind of preserve it.
Definitely, yeah.
And then the other one, another place, is in New York City on Staten Island, to be specific, a place called Fresh Kills, which is first a very odd name, and it's now a very beautiful place to visit.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, there's a kind of strange circularity about it. That Frederick Law Olmsted, who's the sort of great American landscape architect and co-designer of Central Park in New York, actually had a farm on Staten Island before he got into sort of gardening and landscape architecture. And the circularity of it is that Freshkills was basically rather like Fort Bragg, and the Glass Beach. It was the rubbish dump. It was a big rubbish dump for New York out on Staten Island. And actually some of the last stuff dumped on the dump was some of the material from after 9/11, but it's now been reclaimed and turned into a rather beautiful park. So again, it's this idea in a way of, from the rubbish comes some beauty in it.
Yeah, and there was a lot of rubbish. I mean, that was where they were dumping all the trash for New York City for decades.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it was piles and piles of rubbish for decades, as you say.
Now, there's one place in your book that I heard about this for the first time a couple of years ago, and I don't know if you got to visit this place. The photographs are incredible, and it's almost unbelievable that there is a place in Brazil called Fordlandia. And
that's right.
This is a place that Henry Ford started to supply, if I'm correct, rubber for his Model T's.
He sort of wanted to. Basically, Britain pretty much had the monopoly on the rubber trade at that time, and so Ford wanted to secure fresh supplies of rubber and sort of bypass how much extra he might have to pay, decided he would establish a kind of rubber plantation and a town for his employees, as he'd done in kind of Illinois for car workers, you know, creating towns where where the workers would live and then work in his factories and so on. This is a paternalistic idea in a way, and not without problems from a contemporary perspective. So he was sort of attempting to replicate this in Brazil, in this fresh town that he played called Fordlandia. Now, and I mean, Ford was a stickler for many things, and one of his oddities, in a way, was that he was quite obsessed with food, like Kellogg, the great creator of, you know,
yes,
the corn.
Yes.
He had quite a quirky diet and sort of advocated quite, you know, he would eat sort of corn kernels and, you know, advocated eating brown rice and peaches and stuff. And he sort of tried to inflict this diet on the workers in Fordlandia with somewhat disastrous results. The workers actually sort of rioted when the menus of the canteens were changed. They pumped quite a lot of money. I think they pumped something like $20 million.
Wow.
This is back in the interwar period, you know, into the creation of Fordlandia. And there were problems with the growing of rubber in this particular part of Brazil as well. And in the end, the whole thing was just a complete disaster. And in the end, Ford's son sort of sold it to the Brazilian government at some huge loss. And now it's in this rather decayed state. And rather sadly, it sort of mirrors some extent some areas of kind of Detroit in a way, you know, that it has slightly reverted back to nature, and, you know, from having been this plant created by this great car mogul.
Wow. That's kind of off the beaten path, too. I mean, to find Fordlandia, it's not like off a major highway or anything.
No, it's it's a bit of a trek. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And then there's a town also in Florida. And tell me about this town. I think it's called Gibson Town.
That's right. Yes. I mean, this is a creation of a show couple, essentially, a giant and his rather dwarfish wife. And it's off Route 41. And Route 41 is, again, one of those great mythic American roadways. And carnival people, you know, would travel across America on Route 41 to perform their shows, you know, across the states. And Route 41 wound up in Florida. And obviously, you know, the Midwest, you know, places like Michigan and stuff being absolutely freezing cold in the winter months.
Yes.
And, you know, when the show people don't perform. So they would head west and south and head down to Florida and summer at this place. It was originally like just a kind of campsite with some, you know, some fishing laid on. But over time, show people settled in the town, and it became a kind of haven. The term at the time would have been, you know, show freaks. You
yes.
know, so people, you know, giants and or people with physical attributes.
Like the bearded lady, or someone had like hands that weren't fully developed. They called them lobster claws at the time. These were people who were in carnivals and circuses.
Yeah, exactly. Carnival people and so on. So they were. So in a way, they sort of had the run of that. It was their town in a way. It still has kind of strange bylaws where, you know, you could keep exotic animals, you know, like sort of, you know, people would have tigers and lions and stuff, you know, and you know, you could have, you know, fairground equipment could be stored on your lawn and things like that. So, I mean, it's still not that there are, you know, fewer show people there, obviously, because that kind of vaudeville carnival world is, you know, not what it was, but it's still part of the story of this extraordinary place. And there are still people who were performers that live there.
I want to ask you about a couple more places. Once again, this is from the book Atlas of the Unexpected, a fascinating read. And if you like to travel, you may be near one of these places. I'm like, hey, you know what? I'd like to stop by and see Gibson Town or whatever. This is in Indonesia. I might have pronounced this wrong. The Korowai tree houses.
Yes. These are extraordinary structures that the sort of the indigenous tribe create around these tree houses. So they're essentially almost built on one tree. You have like the tree, the trunk is the main part, and then they sort of create these extraordinarily tall kind of tree houses, really. The tribes have lived this way for centuries, and the trees are, tree houses are very extraordinary, really kind of odd, spindly looking. To a certain extent, obviously, the you know, civilization is, or you know, or the Western world, in form of a bit of phrasing of it, has interacted with these people in more recent times, and so fewer of the people live in these tree houses than they did. But there's still a kind of secure group of them that are in existence. They're inhabited, and people can be, you know, shown around them, and or, you know, and they do sell trinkets and things that are made to support the people. But yes, they're extraordinary structures, and it looked like something from, you know, a kind of science fiction film or something, because they're such odd looking little houses.
And then on the flip side of that, there's another group of people in Peru who live on islands that they've created themselves, floating islands.
That's right. Well, kind of slightly edible floating islands as well. They're made out of this particular tree. They weave the islands together. So they're kind of like little, like matting almost.
Yes.
They're kind of matted together, and they live on the islands. And I mean, again, they've become sort of quite a tourist attraction in a way. And then they sort of reached a compromise with that. You tours and so on and sell their wares and so on. But it's a means in which they've managed to kind of sustain their existence on these floating quasi-edible islands. In fact, they live on the same plant, essentially, that they make the islands out of. It's also a staple of their diet.
It's a fascinating book. And some of these places, too, I want to encourage people, some of these places are in the United States. So you may, if you're listening to this, you may like, wow, that's an hour from my house. So there's all sorts of incredible islands, caves, dwellings from indigenous people that still exist today. I absolutely love the book, and I totally enjoyed our conversation today, Travis. Just real quickly, you said you've written some other books, too, that are kind of in the same vein. Can you give a plug for your other books?
So I did a book called The Atlas of Improbable Places, which is a similar sort of tour. I described the Atlas of the Unexpected as the predictable follow-up to the Improbable Atlas, but much in a kind of in a similar vein, really. I'm kind of interested in these odd, fascinating places and sort of the cross-cultural stories and currents that run through all these places.
I absolutely loved it, and I really enjoyed our conversation. Travis, thank you so much, and continued success.
Thank you very much.
If you go to our website, travelwithhawkeye.net, and click on our blog, I'll have links to Travis's two books there. I want to thank Michelle Rodriguez for joining us, having some fun talking about New York City. Of course, Travis Alboro, author of Atlas of Unexpected Places. I'm Mark Hawkeye Lewis. You've been listening to the Travel with Hawkeye podcast. Remember, the world is out there. There's a lot of weird places out there, too. Your adventure awaits.